Part 1. Case Facts. Capture Apartment 213. On entering apartment number 213 of the Oxford Apartments at 924 North 25th Street, Milwaukee, on the 22nd of July 1991, police officers Robert Routh and Rolf Muller were the first to discover that the cool, calm Jeffrey Dahmer standing in front of them had a lot more to hide than anyone ever thought possible. Dahmer had lured Tracy Edwards, an escaped victim, to his apartment by offering him money in exchange for a nude photoshoot of him. He had approached Edwards and his two friends at approximately 6:15 p.m. on that Monday night while they were drinking beers and hanging out, telling them that he was a professional photographer, just visiting from Chicago, who was looking after his sick grandmother and would be willing to offer Edwards $100 if he would be interested in spending some time with him and posing for nude photographs for him. Edwards took up the opportunity and took a cab with him to his apartment. On arrival at apartment 213, he noticed nothing out of the ordinary, except for the odd smell. He must have also realized at this point that it was a more permanent home than Dahmer had initially described, which possibly already set off some internal alarm bells. Dahmer was quick to say, "Don't worry about the smell. A sewer pipe broke and management will take care of it." To ease some of the perceivable tension in the room, Edwards approached the refrigerator to grab some beers, to which Dahmer said, "I wouldn't do that if I were you." He was directed to take a seat on the couch, where his host brought him a beer, followed by a rum and coke. While Dahmer's drinks were usually laced with sedatives, he had run out of pills on this occasion, and Edwards was able to enjoy a normal drink with him. Edwards said that Dahmer acted strangely throughout the night, shifting his body posture and facial expressions from a nice, friendly guy to something sinister, which made him second-guess his decision to pose for any photographs and start plotting his escape. Dahmer must have noticed a change in energy and directed Edwards' attention to his tropical fish tank, making small talk about his new hobby. While Edwards was looking at the fish, Dahmer slammed a handcuff onto his left wrist and pushed a knife into his side, to which he responded calmly that the knife was not necessary, man. He told him that he would do whatever he wanted him to do if he put his knife away. Dahmer took up the opportunity and directed Edwards to his bedroom, where he had The Exorcist 3 playing in the background. During certain scenes, he would start chanting and would come and go, often disappearing into himself and being either in a trance-like state or an overly aggressive, dominant one. A look into the film choices, habits, and evil mentors that shaped some of Jeffrey's behavior will be studied in later chapters of this book. During one of the aggressive stages, Dahmer instructed Edwards to lie on the floor face down with his hands behind his back, intending to cuff both hands and use the knife he had been holding throughout the ordeal. However, Edwards followed his gut instinct not to do that, choosing instead to lie on his side. Dahmer was triggered to join him on the floor and placed his head on Edwards' chest, saying, "I'm going to eat your heart," as he listened to his heartbeat. Instead of recoiling, he unbuttoned his shirt to make Dahmer feel more at ease, a brilliant strategy, after which they returned to the living area to sit on the couch. In a plan to jump out of the window, Edwards said that he needed to use the bathroom again, but Dahmer decided to follow him. Noticing that he was out of it, Edwards hit him as hard as he could in the face and bolted out of the room and out of the door, running down the street half naked and in terror, the handcuff still dangling from his wrist. He managed to find and flag down Milwaukee Police Department officers at an intersection in the area, saying, "This freak, this crazy guy, was trying to hurt me," and directed them to the building that he had just escaped from minutes earlier. They had no idea that they were about to capture one of America's most gruesome and prolific serial killers of all time. Requesting that the distressed Edwards accompany them back to apartment 213, particularly after they were unable to release his cuffs with their keys, and decided that it would be best to go and get the key straight from the source. This must have been very traumatic for Edwards, knowing that Dharma could come across as a nice guy when he needed to, based on his 5-hour experience with him at that point. When the three of them knocked on the door of the apartment just after 11:30 p.m., they were welcomed in by a charismatic Dharma, who confirmed matter-of-factly that he had indeed placed the handcuffs on Edwards. He stated in interviews after his capture that he had no memory of the entire evening, and only remembered hearing the knock on the door and opening it to see the police standing in the hallway, and that he knew he was in trouble. They looked around, seeing no obvious signs of the horrors Edwards had described, except for the nauseating smell that filled the whole apartment. They observed the art on the walls, live plants on the tables and windowsills, the couch, kitchen, lamps, and beer cans that painted a very ordinary picture at first. Neighbors had filed complaints about the smell in the past, but Dharma had always managed to persuade everyone that it was either from a broken freezer that contained meat that went bad, or that his tropical fish tank had gone bust and was the cause of it. He regularly infused his home with the fragrance of burning incense, had a floor fan, and once had neighbor Pamela Bass come over and help him clean his apartment to avoid getting evicted by his landlord. She said that she found him to be quiet and charming, and that he also told her that he had forgotten to plug in his grandmother's freezer, which contained meat that had subsequently gone rotten and filled the apartment with a foul stench. On one occasion, his landlord had questioned him about the strange blue barrel in his apartment, which he casually explained was for the purpose of putting dirty fish tank water in. He was great at thinking on his feet and constantly increased his efforts to avoid detection, which is why he moved the barrel into his bedroom after this incident. Edwards panicked and quickly explained that Dharma had tried to attack him with a knife that they would find in the bedroom. Dharma acted as if he took no notice of this allegation, telling the officers that the keys to the handcuffs were inside his bedside drawer and that he would go and get it. Detective Mueller told him to stand back while he investigated the home, entering the bedroom, which prompted Dharma to try and stop him. A stern "back off" came from Detective Routh, which Dharma knew was the beginning of the end for him. In the bedroom, Mueller immediately spotted the knife under the bed that Edwards had mentioned and noticed the blood-stained walls and the smell of the whole place. He cautiously moved through the room and, to his horror, discovered an open 18th-century-styled bedside drawer, which delicately held a stash of the most gruesome Polaroids arguably ever found. Could they be real? On closer inspection, he saw that the decor in the Polaroids precisely matched the room that he was standing in, which made him feel sick to his stomach. He pulled himself together, walked over to his partner, and slipped him some of the pictures, saying, "These are for real." The Polaroids depicted his victims alive and deceased in various stages of dismemberment and in sexually suggestive positions. They can be viewed here. thecrimemag.com/an unseen collection of Jeffrey Dahmer's Polaroids. Warning, graphic content, viewer discretion advised. Dahmer's pupils exploded as he caught sight of some of his darkest secrets being brought into the light, and as Routh yelled, "Cuff him," tried to resist arrest. The officers overpowered him and handcuffed him, calling for backup. Seeing Dharma face down with his hands cuffed behind his back must have been a moment of victory for Edwards, who had almost been killed in a similar position just an hour earlier. "He wouldn't let me open the fridge," Edwards said, and once Mueller had plucked open the door, it became clear why. In it sat the severed head of a black male victim, Oliver Lacey, with open eyes and a look of shock or excitement still plastered on his face. Dharma turned his head to the side and squeezed out the words, "For what I did, I should be dead." He was arrested on charges of assault and taken into custody at the Milwaukee Police Department in Wisconsin, where he confessed to the 17 murders that he had committed since his first in 1978. In the days following his arrest, the grisly discovery of what he had really been up to, at least for the 13 months leading up to his arrest, was finally uncovered, which was an unprecedented and unforgettable Milwaukee criminal case. If you have never been exposed to this case before, brace yourself, because it is very graphic and disturbing in every sense. Let's take a look at the items that were recovered from the infamous Oxford Apartment 213 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, by personnel from the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office after Dahmer was removed. Miscellaneous items: a Polaroid camera, a King James Version Bible, pornographic videotapes, Cocktails, Chippendales, Tall, Dark, and Handsome, Peep Show, Hard Men 2 and 3, and Tropical Heat Wave, tapes of his favorite movies and shows, Star Wars Episode 6, Return of the Jedi, The Exorcist 3, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, an episode of The Cosby Show, and a lecture on evolution, audio cassettes on creation science, a Latin learning kit, tapes and books, 4 books on the care of aquariums and fish, an aquarium containing plants and several cichlid fish, 74 Polaroids of his victims, alive and in various stages of dismemberment, several identification cards collected from his victims, condiments in the refrigerator, mustard, ketchup, A1 sauce, a can of Crisco grease, contact lens cleaning kit, incense sticks and odor absorb, an Oral 8 toothbrush, and a Miyota laptop. Note, the keys to the handcuffs were never retrieved. Dahmer had thrown them in the trash, saying that he did not need them because he released his victims by dismembering their hands. Tools: a handsaw, a variety of saw blades, 3 electric saws, a claw hammer, a 12-inch butcher knife, a drill with drill bits, a hypodermic needle, tape, wire, a bucket, and a mop. Chemicals: a jug of Clorox bleach, 6 boxes of Soilex, a degreasing agent, 4 boxes of muriatic acid, formaldehyde, ether, and chloroform, sleeping pills, Valium, lorazepam, enamel spray paint, an opened box of baking soda in the refrigerator, and chemical-resistant gloves. Remains of 11 victims: 3 human heads, a heart, liver, a pair of lungs, a kidney, and human intestines were found in the small lift-top freezer. There was also an uneven section of flesh stuck to the ice at the bottom of the freezer. 2 hearts, a portion of muscle, a bag of organs, and a severed head were found in the refrigerator. 2 bleached skulls and an urn containing a set of hands and preserved male genitalia were found in the hallway closet, as well as several glass jars filled with formaldehyde and male genitalia. 3 painted skulls, color Gotham Grey from a commercially available spray paint product, 2 skeletons, and 2 paper bags containing male genitalia and a preserved scalp were found in the filing cabinet in his bedroom, as well as a box with a styrofoam lid containing 2 skulls. 3 headless torsos in various stages of decomposition were found in the 57-gallon drum bathed in hydrochloric acid in his bedroom. His mattress was blood-soaked, and the wall at the head of his bed had large bloodstains seeping into the walls. Art and decoration: various framed posters and artworks of nude male statues and torsos, a black art deco table with a tropical fish tank, live plants, various lamps, a 1- and 3-seater couch, Persian-styled rug, side tables, television, VCR, fans, blue velvet curtains in the bedroom and living area, a telephone book, mirrors, a wall clock, two plastic gargoyle figurines, griffins, a black coffee mug, etc. Neighbors have said that, in hindsight, they knew that something very strange was going on in Dharma's apartment, even though they did not know exactly what it was. They heard power tools buzzing at odd hours of the night, heard cries and thuds on the floor above them, and that there was always that disturbing smell coming directly from his apartment. Dharma told detectives that he had picked the apartment because it was low rent and close to work, and that he was known as one of the only white males in the whole neighborhood. He had installed an alarm system on his front door, a fake video camera in his living area, and locks and bolts on the door to his bedroom as a measure of security, but mostly to prevent any unwanted guests or the landlord from discovering what he was hiding in his bedroom. He told detectives that he was harassed in the neighborhood and remarks were made about him, but that he did not care about it and did not dislike African Americans. The entire apartment block was razed in November 1992. All residents were assisted to find new homes, and it was a celebratory occasion for most to see the Milwaukee Monster's apartment ripped apart. Recent footage has shown that this land is now just a vacant area with green grass and little yellow flowers, with a fence neatly wrapped around it. It looks peaceful and beautiful, even though it will always be a place seeped in pain. Trial, sentencing, and prison. In the early hours of July 23, 1991, Dharma was taken into custody in Wisconsin after being arrested at his apartment on the west side of Milwaukee, requesting cigarettes and coffee before beginning his lengthy 160-page confession. He was questioned by Detective Patrick Kennedy about the evidence found in the apartment and the murders that he had committed, where he showed no restraint in providing the grisly details of every one of the 17 known murders that he had committed since 1978. Detective Patrick Murphy became part of this extensive interview process, which collectively totaled more than 60 hours of audio content. He waived his right to talk to a lawyer throughout the interrogation, saying, "I created this horror, and it only makes sense that I do everything to put an end to it." During the interviews, he confessed to detectives how the skulls they had found were so clean and casually shared how he went about dismembering and sometimes cannibalizing his victims. When asked how he decided which skulls to keep and which to discard, he said that he kept the skulls of the good-looking ones. His father, Lionel Dharma, urged him to take the insanity route so that he could receive the help he needed, which Jeff did. His trial started on January 30, 1992, where the courtroom was filled with icy tension and the emotional families of his known victims. He was tried for 15 counts of murder before Judge Lawrence Graham in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a state that had abolished capital punishment, the death penalty, in 1853. One of the most high-profile defense lawyers in Wisconsin, Gerald Boyle, defended Jeff, and was the same attorney who defended him in a 1988 molestation charge. During that trial, he had gotten to know Dharma very well, and had said that he was a very troubled young man in need of some rehabilitation. Tragically, one of Dharma's youngest victims was the brother of the same boy that he had molested in 1988. The lead prosecutor, E. Michael McCann, presented his case with confidence and ease, arguing that any disability or disorder that Dharma may have had did not impair his planning and calculated decision-making during his killing spree. Multiple defense experts were convinced that Dharma was insane due to his necrophiliac drive and for cannibalizing some of his victims, but many argued that he had premeditated too many details of each murder to be found legally insane. A person can only be found legally insane if it can be proven that he or she did not know that what they were doing was illegal or wrong, and that it was due to a defect of mental disease. On February 14, 1992, closing arguments were presented to the jury by both counsels, with each allotted 2 hours to make their cases. Boyle went first, followed by McCann, who concluded that Dahmer's victims died merely to afford him a period of sexual pleasure. Before sentencing, Dahmer made a full statement, attempting to show remorse and to fully acknowledge what he had done. This was the only time that he wore glasses, saying that he did not wear them throughout the trial because he purposely did not want to see anyone's faces clearly, especially not the victims' families. This exposes some sense of shame or guilt, even though he did not seem sincerely remorseful for what he had done. Here is his full statement before he received his sentence. "Your Honor, it is over now. This has never been a case of trying to get free. I didn't ever want freedom. Frankly, I wanted death for myself. This was a case to tell the world that I did what I did, but not for reasons of hate. I hated no one. I knew I was sick or evil or both. Now I believe I was sick. The doctors have told me about my sickness, and now I have some peace. I know how much harm I have caused. I tried to do the best I could after the arrest to make amends, but no matter what I did, I could not undo the terrible harm I have caused. My attempt to help identify the remains was the best I could do, and that was hardly anything. I feel so bad for what I did to those poor families, and I understand their rightful hate. I now know that I will be in prison for the rest of my life. I know that I will have to turn to God to help me get through each day. I should have stayed with God. I tried and failed and created a Holocaust. Thank God there will be no more harm that I can do. I believe that only the Lord Jesus Christ can save me from my sins. I have instructed Mr. Boyle to end this matter. I do not want to contest the civil cases. I have told Mr. Boyle to try and finalize them if he can. If there is ever money, I want it to go to the families. I have talked to Mr. Boyle about other things that might help ease my conscience in some way of coming up with ideas on how to make some amends to these families, and I will work with him on that. I want to return to Ohio and quickly end that matter so I can put all of this behind me and then come right back here to do my sentence. I decided to go through this trial for a number of reasons. One of the reasons was to let the world know that these were not hate crimes. I wanted the world and Milwaukee, which I deeply hurt, to know the truth of what I did. I didn't want unanswered questions. All the questions have now been answered. I wanted to find out just what it was that caused me to be so bad and evil. But most of all, Mr. Boyle and I decided that maybe there was a way for us to tell the world that if there are people out there with these disorders, maybe they can get help before they end up being hurt or hurting someone. I think the trial did that. The judge in my earlier case tried to help me, and I refused his help, and he got hurt by what I did. I hurt those policemen in the Conorak matter, and I shall ever regret causing them to lose their jobs, and I only hope and pray that they can get their jobs back, because I know that they did their best, and I just plain fooled them. For that, I am sorry. I know I hurt my probation officer who was really trying to help me. I am so sorry for that, and sorry for everyone else I have hurt. I have hurt my mother and father and stepmother. I love them all so very much. I hope that they will find the same peace I am looking for. Mr. Boyle's associates, Wendy and Ellen, have been wonderful to me, helping me through this worst of all times. I want to publicly thank Mr. Boyle. He didn't need to take this case, but when I asked him to help me to find the answers and help others if I could, he stayed with me and went overboard in trying to help me. Mr. Boyle and I agreed that it was never a matter of trying to get off. It was only a matter of which place I would be housed for the rest of my life, not for comfort, but for trying to study me in hopes of helping me and learning to help others who might have problems. I know I'll be in prison. I pledge to talk to doctors who might be able to find the answers. In closing, I just want to say that I hope God has forgiven me. I think He has. I know society will never be able to forgive me. I know the families of the victims will never be able to forgive me for what I have done. But if there is a God in heaven, I promise I will pray each day to ask them for forgiveness when the hurt goes away, if ever. I have seen their tears, and if I could give up my life right now to bring back their loved ones, I would do it. I am so very sorry. Your Honor, I know you are about to sentence me. I ask for no consideration. I want you to know that I have been treated perfectly by the deputies who work for the jail. The deputies have treated me professionally, and I want everyone to know that. They have not given me special treatment. Here is a trustworthy saying that deserves full acceptance. Christ Jesus came into this world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. But for that very reason, I was shown mercy, so that in me, the worst of sinners, Christ Jesus might display his unlimited patience as an example for those who would believe in him and receive eternal life. Now to the King eternal, immortal, invisible, the only God, be honor and glory forever and ever. 1 Timothy 1, 15-17. I know my time in prison will be terrible, but I deserve whatever I get because of what I have done. Thank you, Your Honor, and I am prepared for your sentence, which I know will be the maximum. I ask for no consideration. On July 25, 1991, Dharma was charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder, and by August 22, a further 11 charges were added. On September 14, the final charge was added for a murder Dharma had committed in 1978 in Ohio. He was not charged for the death of Stephen Toomey or the attempted murder of Tracy Edwards, however, due to a lack of evidence. On January 13, 1992, his trial commenced, where he pled not guilty by reason of insanity to the 15 counts of first-degree murder. Jurors considered all evidence, with 10 out of the 12 ruling him sane during the time that he had committed each murder, which was the minimum number of votes needed for a unanimous verdict. He had convinced detectives to bring him a pair of trousers, a button-down shirt, and some proper shoes, saying that he did not want to be sentenced while wearing the county jail orange jumpsuit. On February 15, 1992, he was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility for parole in each case, totaling a sentence of 957 years in prison. On May 1, 1992, an additional life sentence was added for the murder of Stephen Hicks, following the discovery of some of his remains in the forest behind Dharma's childhood home. After spending 10 minutes in a private meeting with his father and stepmother, he was transferred to the Columbia Correctional Institute in Portage, Wisconsin, and spent the first year in solitary confinement for his own physical safety. His mother, Joyce, who had not seen him since Christmas in 1983, started regularly communicating with him, revealing that he told her that he did not care what happened to him when she urged him to stay safe. He had accepted his fate and any punishment that he might face for what he had done. After 1 year, and with his consent, he was transferred to a less secure unit, where he could share mealtimes with other inmates and work for 2 hours a day in the toilet block. In Lionel Dharma's book, titled A Father's Story, he said that Jeff's only complaint was that the food in prison was bad. Having a Bible to read, something he requested in his interviews with Detective Murphy in 1991, Dharma converted to Christianity and was baptized in the prison whirlpool by Minister Roy Ratcliffe in May 1994. His initial prison schedule involved a 6:30 a.m. wake-up, breakfast, sleeping until noon, lunch, sleeping until 4 p.m., dinner, and watching TV. After integrating with some of the inmates, cleaning duty was added to his schedule, where he cleaned the gym, locker area, and washrooms. In July 1994, he survived an attack from fellow inmate Osvaldo Durruti, who used a prison-made weapon made from a toothbrush and razor blades to try to slash his throat after a church service. His wounds were superficial, and he did not make a big deal of the ordeal. In interviews, he said that he was not aware of any nicknames that anyone had given him, such as the Chop Chop Man. But fellow inmates simply said, "There's Dharma, the murderer," as they passed him. He was not allowed to smoke in prison, did not receive special meals, did not make friends with the guards, as some reports claimed, and did not read the newspaper. The only visitors he had were his attorneys, members of the Milwaukee Police Department, his father and stepmother, and once in a while his mother. On November 28, 1994, Fellow inmate Christopher Scarver bludgeoned him and another inmate, Jesse Anderson, to death with a metal bar while they were momentarily left alone in the gym and locker area. Scarver said that he was provoked by the two inmates, who poked him in the back and laughed at him, and felt that it was something that the prison guards let happen as they wanted the unremorseful Dahmer to be dealt with. Scarver had observed Dahmer taunting inmates and guards in the chow hall by shaping limbs out of prison food and covering them with ketchup for a laugh, as well as enjoying the thrill of instilling fear in guards by saying, "I bite," as he passed them. Before he beat him, he showed him a newspaper clipping that he had about his case, asking him if it was true, finding what he had done abhorrent. When Dahmer had said or nodded yes, he was killed by Scarver, not making a sound while he was being killed, according to his killer. Jeff was found in a pool of blood with his head smashed in and subsequently rushed to hospital, where he was pronounced dead just after 9 a.m. Ironically, the weapon that killed him in prison was similar to what he had used to kill his first victim, Stephen Hicks. What started with a barbell was also ended with a barbell. This meant that Dahmer had served almost 3 years of his sentence before being killed at the age of 34. His body was kept as legal evidence for Scarver's murder trial in May of 1995, which added 2 life imprisonment sentences to this inmate's existing charges. 10 months later, in September 1995, Dahmer's body was cremated, with one exception. His mother had fought to have his brain preserved in formaldehyde and kept on the shelf at the University of Wisconsin Medical School for further studies to see if biological factors influenced his actions. His ashes were split equally between his father and mother, with his father and stepmother putting him to rest by scattering their half of the ashes in an unknown location. Jeff's father fought relentlessly to have his son's brain cremated in accordance with his will, expressing that there was no purpose in studying a dead brain and that he should have been studied further in a psychiatric institution while he was still alive. On December 12, 1995, Judge Daniel George ruled in favor of this, saying, "I think the closure aspect of it, bringing this chapter to a conclusion without perpetuating more gruesome, ghoulish kinds of interest, was more beneficial for the victims, community, and families." Modus operandi. Jeffrey Dahmer looked and sounded innocent, even while he was expressing his worst actions to the media once he was captured. His mannerisms and tone of voice tended to soften hearts and stir empathy in people, with some saddened by the way that he was killed in prison. He rarely smiled and was mostly expressionless, with a monotone voice and sea-toned eyes that looked like they had lost their light a long time ago. He was described as a tragic lost soul, a sad loner, a troubled young man, etc. And while Dahmer successfully portrayed himself this way, he was not labeled as the Milwaukee Monster for no reason. His MO always involved striking up a conversation where he approached a group of people or an individual who looked like they could use some help, and he certainly offered it to them. He offered them company, pleasure, alcohol, and or money, and lured them into his trap after gaining their trust completely. He was not known for his pickup lines. "I like the way you dance," was an example given by a survivor, but did always manage to come across as a friendly, easygoing guy who would never cause any trouble. He was a master at diffusing suspicions and eliminating any red flags, and always had an answer for everything. Before going out, he would pre-crush sedatives in a glass and leave it on his kitchen countertop, ready to prepare his signature cocktail if he managed to return home with someone who fit the profile. He would often sit alone in bars, drinking and observing the gay scene, and would be flattered if somebody approached him instead of having to pluck up the courage to approach them. Once in conversation, his go-to narrative was that he was a professional photographer, visiting from Chicago, who would pay $50 to $100 for a photo shoot with a model, and that they could have a couple of drinks and maybe even some light sex if they felt up to it. He met all his known victims in gay bars or dance clubs, at bus stops on the way home, and at the Grand Avenue Mall. He told detectives that he did not drink every day and did not consider himself an alcoholic, but that he did drink whenever he had decided that he was going to kill someone. He also stated that he was always drunk when luring them home, killing them, and that he drank throughout the dismembering process. He expressed that drinking helped him to get into the frame of mind and made it easier for him. Once he had lured someone home with him, he gave them a drink, which was usually rum and coke poured over 5 to 7 crushed pills, which was undetectable by his guest. Sometimes he offered coffee and or Bailey's Irish Cream. The pills were a powerful concoction of Halcyon, Valium, and other sedatives, which he always had handy and had a doctor's prescription for, Dr. Olson of West Ellis Memorial Hospital and Dr. Hong, whether at his grandmother's house or in his own apartment. During his questioning, he told detectives that he convinced doctors that he struggled with insomnia, which is why they described these to him, but that he had only taken one pill himself every 6 months or so, using the rest to drug his victims as early as his days in the bathhouses. He initiated sexual activities by requesting his victims to pose for him, often handcuffing them and simulating bondage and control over them until they fell asleep, which is when he felt most aroused. He then fondled, sucked, rubbed, and enjoyed their bodies without their consent, date-raping them as they slipped into a deep, forever sleep. He often played pornographic movies in the background, or put on his favorite movie, The Exorcist 3, while he enjoyed himself. He listened to their hearts beating in their chests, and trained himself to know when the pills were wearing off, ensuring that he strangled them to death before they woke up, either with his bare hands or a black strap that he had bought. Once deceased, Jeffrey struggled to discard of his lovers, expressing how sentimental and overcome with loss he felt. He would sometimes sleep next to their bodies, cuddle them, kiss them, and engage in necrophilia with them. Colonel Robert Ressler, a former FBI behavioral analyst, interviewed Dahmer and revealed more details about his MO than expected. He said that Jeff dragged some of his victims' bodies into his bathtub, which he filled with ice, to keep them cold and preserve them for longer. He had ice-cold showers before he had fun with them, which he told Ressler was uncomfortable but beneficial so as not to melt the ice. He was fascinated by corpses and dissected, dismembered, and indulged in them without any remorse. Psychiatrists have noted that he had to be drunk to be able to dissect and discard them the way that he did. But it seems that alcohol only heightened the experience for him rather than simply numbing it out. Dahmer was particularly aroused by the viscera, carefully plucking out organ after organ, often keeping some for consumption. He dug out his victims' hearts, consuming some and discarding some. He stripped bicep muscles, thigh and calf muscles, and chunks of flesh to taste, saying that it helped him to possess them permanently, believing that eating them made these victims a part of him forever. He decided who to keep and who to discard, and who to eat and who not to, depending on how attractive they were, completely dehumanizing them. He attempted to flay multiple victims, never succeeding at his efforts to preserve their skin. He boiled their skulls and body parts and discarded the jelly-like remains, throwing the rest of the hacked and chopped parts out in regular trash bags. He boiled the heads and kept the skulls of some victims, sometimes coating them or painting them, and storing them for a shrine that he said he would have completed within 6 months if he had not been caught. Bones were bleached, hands and genitals were preserved in jars or boxes, and Polaroids depicting decapitated bodies in suggestive poses, and during the process of dismemberment were used for masturbation. He did not keep any of their clothes, jewelry, or personal items except identity cards, either burning them or discarding them in the trash along with their remains. Dahmer said that it was his fear of abandonment that led him to slay his victims. But the fact that he had many other dates in between these murders who came and went exposes just how little value these words have. It was the only way I knew of to keep them there, to keep them with me. It gave me a sense of total control and increased the sexual thrill, I guess, knowing that I had total control of them and could do with them as I wished. That was the motive. There was no hatred involved at all, he said. When asked how he would have felt if he had met someone who theoretically wanted to stay for several months or weeks, he said, "The person would have to be totally compliant, willing to do whatever I wanted, and there just aren't many people like that. He had no interest in meeting anyone's needs, in giving them pleasure, or in entertaining their humanity. Instead, he drilled holes into some victims' heads and injected muriatic acid or boiling water into it, trying to create living zombies who had no will or thought of their own. At school, at the army, at work, and in bars or clubs, Dahmer was always perceived as a bit strange and seemingly lonely, but no one had ever guessed that he would be capable of these gruesome acts. He was an impulsive and creative liar who could think on his feet and manage to convince everyone he encountered in his short life that he meant no harm. At his trial, he stated that he hated no one and implied that his crimes were love crimes. Irrespective of what Dahmer did or said, he always had the ability to create a climate of deep compassion for him, where he portrayed himself as someone terribly lost and lonely who just needed some love. The way that he presented himself made it easier for the world to romanticize him, because he kept everyone's focus on the fact that he just wanted unconditional closeness. As his high school classmate, John Backdurf, said, "Dahmer was a tragic figure, but that only applies until the moment he kills someone. While sadness shaped him, it can never justify what he chose to do with it. There are millions of sad and lonely people in the world who do not kill people. He was a softer serial killer in a sense, because he did not enjoy causing physical pain and humiliating his victims while they were conscious. But he was still a mass murderer, which should not be forgotten." Nonetheless, Dahmer managed to present his motives in such a way that there will always be divided opinions about it, one of sympathy and one of none. Known victims: Stephen Hicks, June 18, 1978. 3 weeks after his 18th birthday and graduation from Revere High School in Bath, Ohio, Dahmer was isolated at his family home after his father had moved into a motel in the area and his mother and brother had moved to Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, following their divorce. He found himself completely neglected at the age of 18 and soothed himself with alcohol and homosexual fantasies, unbeknownst to his father. On June 18, 1978, on a drive back from a shopping mall in the car that his father had given him to use, he noticed a topless male hitchhiker along the road and drove past him, observing him in the rearview mirror. One of his homosexual teenage fantasies included picking up a hitchhiker, taking him home, and having complete control over him, and for a split second he overcame his impulses to make the stop. Moments later, he reversed his car and offered the man a ride, which Hicks happily accepted. On the way, Dahmer invited him to make a quick stop at his house to have some beers, a joint, and chill out for a bit. Hicks was on his way to a rock concert, so it was a no-brainer. The pair drank beers for a couple of hours, according to Dahmer, after which Hicks said that he needed to get going. Dahmer's fear of abandonment consumed him completely, and resulted in the impulsive decision to knock his new friend unconscious with a 10-pound dumbbell. He then strangled him with a bar of the dumbbell, stripped him naked, and masturbated over his corpse. He felt in complete control of someone for the first time in his life and enjoyed the thrill of it, even though this murder was an accident, as he told the FBI. He then dragged his body down to the crawl space underneath the house and dismembered it with a knife, putting the pieces of flesh into 3 trash bags and dragging them into the car that his dad had left him to use. He took a 3 a.m. drive with the trash bags in the back seat and lost concentration, swaying across the road. Police in the area noticed and stopped him, instructing him to get out of the car and perform a standard drug test. Despite having several beers and getting high that night, Dahmer was able to pull himself together and pass the drug test with ease. When officers scanned his car with their flashlights and asked what the trash bags were all about, he said coolly that it was just some old trash that he still needed to take to the dump, and that he needed some time away from home where his parents were getting divorced and fighting all the time. He had already disposed of the victim's necklace and the knife in a river on his drive and left the clothes to burn in a barrel near his house. They let him go, sympathizing with the poor kid for his family situation, not checking what the trash bags contained. If they had, it would have been the end of Dahmer's killing. After the cop scare, he turned around and went back home, pushing the bags into a drainage pipe, leaving them there for a week and a half. When he returned to them, he separated the flesh from the bones, destroying it in acid and pulverizing the bones with a sledgehammer, which he scattered over the woody ravine in an area behind his house in a 360-degree pattern to avoid them ever being discovered. 13 years later, on July 31, 1991, police officers found more than 50 bone fragments, including ribs, vertebrae, and pieces of skull, which were later positively identified as the remains of Stephen Hicks. They also found a large quantity of blood and a bloody handprint in the crawl space where Dahmer had described dissecting the body. During the police interrogations after his capture in July of 1991, he drew detectives a map of the 1.7-acre property and the location where he crushed and scattered the bones. Stephen Hicks's remains were buried in Greensburg Cemetery in Summit, Ohio, where his family held a private funeral for him. They had been searching for him for 13 years, using private investigators and psychic mediums to help them and offering a reward of $2,500 for any information on their son. After many Christmases spent without him in heartache, they finally got some closure. When the police asked him how he remembered so much detail about this victim, including his name, he said, "Well, you never forget your first one. Rest in peace, Stephen Hicks, 22nd of June, 1959, to the 18th of June, 1978. Stephen Toomey, November 20th, 1987. 1 week before Thanksgiving in 1987, and 9 years after his first murder, 27-year-old Dahmer was frequenting the gay bars in downtown West Allis and had booked room number 507 at the Ambassador Hotel for a Friday night. He was, at the time, living with his grandmother in the same area, but desired a night of privacy with his next date. He met 24-year-old Stephen Toomey at Club 219, and after hitting it off, the pair decided to head to the hotel room, where Dahmer intended to date-rape whoever he brought back with him. He had prepared for it by buying a bottle of Coke, rum, and packing a pack of sleeping pills. On arrival, he made Toomey the drink and watched him fall asleep. Dahmer does not have any recollection of the events of that night, so there is no way of knowing whether Toomey was date-raped once he fell asleep or not. After passing out from too much drinking, Dahmer woke up with his forearms and fists stinging and bruised, seeing his date's chest beaten in, a cracked rib on his left side, and blood dripping from his mouth. Toomey was dead. Dharma was shocked and had no idea what he had done, but felt that this meant that he had become an out-of-control killer. He calmly booked an additional night at the hotel, shoved Toomey's body into the closet, and headed out to the Grand Avenue Mall, where he bought a large suitcase with wheels and straps from Woolworths. When he got back to the hotel, he squeezed Toomey into the bag, saying it was a perfect fit, and wheeled it out in the quiet hours of the night. He called a cab and asked the driver to help him load the heavy bag into the trunk. "You have a dead body in there or something?" chuckled the driver, to which Dharma answered, "I sure do." Sarcasm, with a pinch of truth, became Dharma's general way of communicating with the world. On arrival at his grandmother's house in West Ellis, he took the suitcase into the basement and waited a few days before dismembering his victim, which took only 2 hours. He separated the flesh from the bone, placing small chunks in trash bags, and then wrapped the bones in an old sheet to crush with a sledgehammer, which he then also put in the trash bags. He discarded everything except his head, which he kept wrapped in a blanket, possibly for necrophiliac purposes, and watched as Toomey's remains disappeared forever as the trash collection took the bags. After some time, Dharma boiled the head in Soilex to remove the flesh, eventually also discarding it after it became too brittle from bleaching it. He ripped up the suitcase and threw it in the trash, so that it would never be used or discovered again. The Milwaukee County District Attorney only brought charges where murder could be proven beyond reasonable doubt. And because Dharma could not remember murdering this victim, he was never formally charged for it. His remains have never been found. Toomey was an artist and dancer, and his last known address was a rented apartment in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The last time his family saw him was on September 15, 1987, 2 months before his death, filing a missing persons report by the end of that year. Once receiving some closure from police in 1991, his family arranged a memorial monument for him at the Holy Family Catholic Cemetery in Ontonagon, Michigan, which was his birth town. It reads, "We'll love you forever. Rest in peace, Stephen Toomey, 19th of December 1962 to the 20th of November 1987. James Dockstader, January 16, 1988. James Jamie Dockstader was a 14-year-old Native American boy who had run away from home on January 16, 1988, according to his mother, Debbie Vega, which was the same day that Dharma had met him outside a gay bar at 1 a.m. While reports have said that James was a prostitute, it does not seem evident that he had a habit of prostitution, but had rather accepted money in exchange for modeling for Dharma because he wanted cash to catch a bus out of town. He had fled home after a fight with his abusive stepfather and made his way to the bustling downtown area, which he could handle as a street-smart kid. Jamie's case was truly one of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, with Dharma seeking out vulnerable people to victimize. He approached James and asked him a few questions, offering him $50 to come home with him and pose for nude pictures, which he agreed to. 28-year-old Dharma knew how much the kid wanted the cash. The pair took a bus to his grandmother's house, but were not able to sit next to each other as the bus was crowded at the time. Once they arrived, he made him a drink of Irish cream and sleeping pills, and then began to kiss him, touch him, and masturbate with him. Dockstader said that he needed to be home by the morning, which triggered Dharma's twisted urges to keep his victim with him at all costs. When Dockstader had fallen asleep, Dharma placed an old sheet on the floor and gently placed him on it. He strangled him, and once he was dead, hugged and kissed him, wrapping him in the sheet to leave in the chilly fruit cellar for over a week. After doing this, he went upstairs to have breakfast with his grandmother before she left for church. 1 week later, he dismembered the body, separating the flesh from the bone with a knife and cutting it into small pieces to place in trash bags. The skull and bones were pulverized with a sledgehammer and all remains were discarded in the same manner as his previous victim, never to be found again. During the interviews with Dahmer, he was shown photographs of all suspected victims. He was not able to identify James by a photo of his face, but positively identified him as his victim after seeing the two scars that he had above his nipples. He had previously mentioned these details, and once police had his confession, they approached Doc Stater's mother to confirm whether he had any marks on his body as he had described. His mother was able to confirm that her son had these marks from a bicycle accident when he was younger. A life sentence was added to Dahmer's charges for the murder of James Doc Stater, even though no remains have ever been found. Dahmer eventually told detectives that, upon removing his internal organs, he had noticed that this victim only had one kidney, specifically his left kidney. He had a mother and three siblings, which described him as a hyperactive, misunderstood kid. Doc Stater had been arrested by the Milwaukee police before, but his mother did not give details about the arrests, simply saying that he cut school and got into trouble sometimes. His mother had later also fled her abusive husband and divorced him, taking her three remaining children with her to start a new life in Tampa Bay, returning to Milwaukee a few times only to search for her missing son on the streets after filing a missing persons report by the end of January 1988. His family arranged a memorial monument in Stockbridge Indian Burial Grounds, Wisconsin, which displays James's favorite Bible verse, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." Rest in peace, James Doc Stater, 1st of March, 1973, to the 16th of January, 1988. Richard Guerrero, March 24th, 1988. Richard Guerrero, a 22-year-old Hispanic male, met Dahmer outside of the Phoenix, a gay bar in the downtown area of West Allis, Wisconsin. In his usual MO, Dahmer offered Guerrero $50 to return home with him for some company, which he agreed to. According to police reports, Dahmer admitted that his offer was officially for oral sex and drinking together. Guerrero's family maintained that he was not homosexual, insisting that he had girlfriends and did not have the money to sustain a double life. However, some reports have said that Guerrero was bisexual or bicurious, which could be one of the reasons that he would have taken up Dahmer's offer just to fool around a little, without any pressure to perform any other acts. The pair returned to his grandmother's house in West Allis, where Dahmer prepared his usual cocktail of rum, coke, and sleeping pills in the basement for him. Guerrero drank it and allegedly performed oral sex on Dahmer, after which he fell asleep. Dahmer then strangled him with a black strap that he had bought in advance, premeditated, and then initiated his dismemberment routine without waiting the usual few days to do it. He removed the flesh from the bone, cut it into small chunks, and placed it in trash bags, and then pulverized the bones to discard with it. No remains were ever found. Guerrero's family had reported him missing on March 29, 1988, only receiving some closure after Dahmer was captured in 1991. Even though there was no physical evidence available, Dahmer was convicted of Guerrero's murder after identifying him through a series of photographs and relating the graphic details of his murder. No memorial monument or burial site has been listed for this victim. His mother expressed how kind Guerrero was as a person, often taking her shopping or running errands for her. Rest in peace, Richard Guerrero, 1965, to the 24th of March, 1988. Anthony Sears, March 25th, 1989. One day before Easter, Dahmer met 24-year-old aspiring model Anthony Sears in La Cage, a popular gay bar in downtown West Allis. It was known as a premier gay dance club, which offered memberships and featured a cover charge to enter. DJ Tony Aiello presided at the club for over 20 years, and the owners, George and Corey, kept the club new and exciting for all their clientele. Just before closing time on Saturday, March 25th, 1989, Sears approached Dharma and struck up a conversation. Dharma was flattered, describing him as extremely attractive. He expressed that he did not intend to commit a crime that night, rather just enjoying the club as he did in between his murders. In this instance, he took the chance to ask his new friend to join him for a few drinks at his house, which Sears agreed to. The pair caught a ride with one of Sears' friends, a white female who dropped them off at the Mai Key Tavern near his grandmother's house. Jeff covered his tracks so carefully, ensuring that the friend would not know exactly where he lived. Police reports show that Dharma had offered his victim money in exchange for a photo shoot, as always, likely boosting his hopes to further expand his modeling portfolio. They took a stroll from the tavern to his grandmother's house, where Jeff prepared his classic cocktail for Anthony and had sex with him, watching him get drowsy and fall asleep. Once asleep, he strangled him to death, waiting for the next morning, Easter Sunday, to dismember the body. His family reported him missing on March 25, 1989, the night that he met Dharma and did not return home. Jeff's grandmother, Catherine Dharma, was at church for a few hours on this day, and he used the space and time he had to drag the body to his grandmother's bath to decapitate, dismember, and attempt to flay him. He discarded the flesh and bone in trash bags, as with his previous crimes, but this time keeping the head and genitals as a souvenir, likely because he found this victim so attractive, a motive in later crimes for keeping skulls and body parts. He preserved the head and genitalia in acetone, later painting them and wrapping them in a blanket. He took these remains to work in a carry case, where it stayed in his locker for almost a year before he transported it to his one-bedroom Oxford apartment. In May, 2 months after committing this murder, Dharma was sentenced to a one-year work release program and 5 years probation following second-degree sexual assault charges on a 13-year-old boy, which explains how and why he decided to keep these remains in his locker at work. He could not risk leaving it at his grandmother's house, and clearly could not take it with him to prison, so it stayed stashed in his locker at the Ambrosia Chocolate Company during this time. He was released on probation 2 months early, after which he took the remains out of his locker and transported them to his apartment. Police were able to identify Sears through dental records and from Dharma identifying him through photos. Remains were buried in Arlington Park Cemetery, Greenfield, Milwaukee. Rest in peace, Anthony Sears. 28th of January, 1965 to the 25th of March, 1989. Raymond Smith, May 20th, 1990. Dharma's rental contract for apartment 213 at the Oxford Apartments in Milwaukee shows an initial lease date for May 13th, 1990. Within 1 week of moving in, he met 32-year-old Raymond Smith at Club 219, also known as Cash D and Ricky Lee Beeks, luring him home by offering him his standard $50 to pose for photographs and have sex. The pair took a cab home, where Smith posed for him, watched videos, and drank Dharma's classic 7 sleeping pill cocktail. Once he had fallen asleep, Dharma strangled him to death with his bare hands and engaged in necrophilia with his body. The next day, he took a trip to the mall and purchased a Polaroid camera, which would be the start of his terrifying picture collection. Back at home with his new gadget, the excited Dharma put Smith's body in various suggestive positions and captured his fantasy becoming reality on camera. These first Polaroids were shoved into his bedroom cabinet drawer for easy access to remember him by, as he described it. He then took the body to his bathroom for decapitation and dismemberment, boiling chunks of arms, legs, and pelvis in a steel kettle with the aid of Soilex, a powerful degreaser. He was then able to rinse the bones more easily in the sink and dissolve the entire skeleton in acid, except for the skull, which he kept, and spray-painted in the shade Gotham Grey. Once the skull was repaired, it was placed on a black towel in the filing cabinet alongside Sears' skull, where his museum of horrors started being formed. According to some reports, part of Smith's skeletal remains were kept and placed around the apartment as ornaments. Once police had captured Dahmer in 1991, they were able to positively identify the skull as Smith's remains, as well as through photo identification with Dahmer. Raymond had never been reported missing. He had previously been in prison for burglary charges and was referred to as Cash D in Dahmer's trial, which was his street name and a tattoo that he had on his chest, a detail that Dahmer had also referred to in interrogations. There is no burial site listed for him. Rest in peace, Raymond Smith, 1957 to the 20th of May, 1990. Edward Smith, June 23, 1990. 27-year-old Edward Eddie Smith was allegedly a friend of 30-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, with the pair seen often hanging out together as they frequented the same bars. He was not related to Raymond Smith, the previous victim. He was nicknamed the Sheikh for the turbans he liked to wear and was a charismatic and energetic person, according to his friends and family. He was once a dancer for the Milwaukee Ballet and enjoyed wearing makeup, dressing flamboyantly, and dancing in the gay clubs on weekends. Tony Timer, a local bartender and friend of Eddie's, said, "Eddie was such a wild, crazy person, you couldn't help but like him." He said that he often saw Dahmer sitting in the corner of the bar in his own little world, as if he were waiting for something, and that his friend Eddie had become comfortable around Dahmer. On June 23, 1990, he danced with Dahmer at the Phoenix Bar in West Ellis, and later was invited back to the apartment to pose for nude photographs in exchange for $50 to $100. Eddie, an aspiring model, had wanted to make some money and pose for a professional photographer, so he agreed and took a cab with him to apartment 213. Tony Timer says that he saw his friend leave with Dahmer after saying, "I'll see you later, I've got to go make some money," and Timer understood that he was leaving with Dahmer possibly to make some money for sexual favors. Timer never saw his friend again. According to Dahmer, they had oral sex, and then Smith fell asleep, after which he strangled him to death just like his other victims. He took photographs of his body in various positions and throughout the stages of dismemberment, separating flesh from bone and discarding most of the remains in the trash. He held onto his skeleton and kept it in the freezer to see if it preserved better than the brittle, bleached bones of previous victims, as well as attempting to dry the skull in the oven. The skeleton did not hold as well as he had hoped, and the skull exploded in the oven, so there were no remains left to find of this victim. He was identified by Dahmer through a series of photographs, who said that he felt horrible that he did not have any of his remains to keep. He also destroyed the Polaroids of this victim once all remains were discarded. He was reported missing by his sister, Caroline Smith, after failing to return home from his night out on June 23, 1991. He had said that he would not be out for long. He had a big family, who all reported that they had not seen him since his disappearance. In April of the following year, Caroline had received a call from a soft-spoken male who said, "Don't bother looking for your brother." When she asked why, he said, "Because he's dead." Asking how he knew, he said, "Because I killed him." She immediately hung up the call and alerted the police, but there was no evidence that this was Dahmer, even though it most likely was. There is no memorial site listed for this victim. Rest in peace, Edward Smith, 1963 to the 23rd of June, 1990. Ernest Miller, September 3rd, 1990. Ernest Miller, a 22-year-old Chicago native, was in Milwaukee to visit his family for Labor Day weekend, arriving on September 1st, 1990. He left his aunt, Vivian Miller's house, in the early morning hours of September 3rd, 1990, and was never seen again. During the day, on September 3, 1990, Miller encountered Dahmer outside a bookstore on North 27th Street, Milwaukee, most likely being approached by the professional photographer. He was offered $50 to pose for nude photographs and returned with Dahmer to his Oxford apartment. Once there, Dahmer prepared a drink for him, but this time he did not have sufficient supply to guarantee the knockout effect that he was used to. Dahmer alleges that the pair had sex before Miller dozed off, but armed with only two sleeping pills, he allegedly woke up again. Dahmer panicked, knowing that he could not physically fight him, so he stabbed him in his carotid artery with a knife and watched him bleed to death. This led to his mattress and back wall being drenched in blood, as detectives found when they captured him on July 22, 1991. He put Miller's body in a variety of poses, taking multiple Polaroids of his body before and during dismemberment. He dragged the body to the bathtub and cut open his abdomen, performing necrophiliac acts on the body. The heart and other organs were removed. Flesh was cut off in chunks, and this time Dahmer had the urge to keep some of his victim for consumption. "I wanted them to be a part of me forever, to permanently possess them," he said. Some reports claim that Dahmer kissed Miller's decapitated head and spoke to the cadaver throughout dissection. He wrapped his heart, biceps, and chunks of leg tissue in plastic and stored it in his refrigerator's freezer compartment for later consumption. Limbs and other remains were boiled for over 2 hours in a combination of water and Soilex, which turned into a jelly-like substance that could be poured down the drain. The bones were then bleached, laid out on a newspaper to dry, and kept. Miller's head was initially stored in the refrigerator, but Dahmer later decided to boil it as well, stripping the flesh and applying a fresh coat of enamel on for long-term preservation. After Dahmer's capture, Lieutenant Johnson was able to compare dental records with the skulls found in the apartment, positively identifying one as Ernest Miller's. His skeletal bones were found in the filing cabinet in Dahmer's bedroom. His grandmother, Corrine Miller, said that she received a phone call approximately 2 weeks after Ernest's disappearance, with a man moaning and groaning on the other end saying, "Help me, help me, help me." Dahmer denied making any phone calls to the families of his victims, but it seems plausible that he did. There is no burial or memorial site listed for this victim. Rest in peace, Ernest Miller, 1968 to the 3rd of September, 1990. David Thomas, September 24th, 1990. David Thomas encountered Jeffrey Dahmer sometime during the day after being dropped off at the Grand Avenue Mall by some relatives, where he was invited back to his apartment for a few drinks, with the additional temptation of earning some cash if he wanted to pose for some photographs. The pair took a cab to Dahmer's apartment, where a sleeping pill cocktail was given to his new guest. Once Thomas had fallen asleep, Dahmer scanned his victim's face and body, but did not feel the surge of attraction that he was used to after sedating people, instead drowning in his feelings of depression and suicidal ideation, feelings that he once shared with his parole officer. For a moment, he contemplated just letting this one go, but after deciding that Thomas would be angry when he realized he had been drugged, Dahmer opted to rather strangle him to death, blindly following his routine dismemberment, grisly photo shoot, and discard of remains. He intentionally did not keep any part of this victim, leaving only the Polaroids in his drawer as part of his killing collection. In interviews, he said, "He just wasn't my type." Sadly, Thomas's sister had to identify her brother by viewing a Polaroid of his face, which police compared to a photograph that she had of him and were able to authenticate. There is no memorial site listed for this victim. He was 23 years old and had a 3-year-old daughter at the time, who he regularly visited. Thomas was on probation for retail theft and did not have a permanent residence of his own, sleeping at his girlfriend's house for most of the 12 years leading up to his death. His girlfriend filed a missing persons report in October 1991, even though she was used to him sometimes not returning home for weeks. At the trial, his mother, Inez Thomas, said, "That was my baby boy you took away from me." But Dharma did not lift his head to meet her gaze. Instead, he just stared down at the floor and listened to her. After murdering David Thomas, Dharma went through 5 months of unsuccessful attempts to lure men back to his apartment, telling his parole officer that he was strongly contemplating suicide due to mental and financial struggles. However, no matter how down in the dumps Dharma got, he never stopped trying to pursue new victims. Rest in peace, David Thomas, 1967 to the 24th of September, 1990. Curtis Durrell Strauter, March 7th, 1991. Curtis Strauter's grandmother, Catherine Strauter, last saw him on February 18th, 1991. He was 1 month away from turning 18 when he met Dharma at a bus stop outside Marquette University. Dharma struck up a conversation and offered him the opportunity to be photographed and paid for his modeling, with the bonus of sexual activity afterward if he felt up to it. The pair made their way back to the apartment by bus, where Dharma fixed him a drink and got his camera ready for the photo shoot that he had wanted for the last 5 months. Once Strauter was knocked out, Dharma strangled him with a strap, had necrophiliac oral sex, and then began the most detailed dismemberment photo shoot of his life. He defleshed the bones and boiled body parts in his Soilex solution, pouring the slimy substance down the drain as he prepared the parts he wanted to keep. Detectives were able to retrieve his skull, hands, and genitals from the apartment. The skull was bleached but unpainted, and the genitals had been painted a more flesh-colored tone and preserved in formaldehyde. While it was not confirmed, it is highly likely that he cannibalized this victim as he did with the previous one. Strauter was positively identified through dental records from the skull, as well as being identified by Dharma through photographs. His remains were buried at the Holy Cross Cemetery and Mausoleum in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where his tombstone reads, "My dearest grandson, I love you." An interesting fact that police reports show is that a phone call was made to Mr. Michael Lizowski on Sunday, February 17, 1991, at 6:40 p.m., 18 days before Curtis Strauter's murder. Strauter lived with Lizowski, and Dharma revealed that he allowed guests to use his phone in his apartment if they needed to. This means that Strauter had been there before, which sheds new light on Dharma's case. Seeing as he was quite active on the gay dating scene, some of his victims could have visited him more than just the one time. Rest in peace, Curtis Strauter, 6th of April, 1973, to the 7th of March, 1991. Errol Lindsay, April 7th, 1991. Errol Lindsay had just turned 19 when he encountered Dharma on a Sunday afternoon near the Grand Avenue Mall, where he was getting a key cut. On the corner of 27th and Kilbourne, across from the same bookstore where he met Ernest Miller, Dharma approached Lindsay at the bus stop and offered him money to pose for some photographs. According to his friends and family, Lindsay was a heterosexual and must have accepted the offer purely to make some cash before returning home. The pair took a bus to Dharma's apartment, where Lindsay was given a drink containing sleeping pills, likely a slightly lower dose than his usual 7-pill concoction. Once he had fallen asleep, Dharma took a newly bought drill and drilled a hole in the top of Lindsay's head, and then used a hypodermic needle to push muriatic acid into the hole. He wanted to create a living zombie sex slave and waited for the sleeping pills to wear off to see the reaction. Lindsay woke up and scratched his head, saying, I have a headache. What time is it? This was not the response Dharma was expecting. In interviews, he relayed how disappointed he was that his experiment had not worked to take away Lindsay's consciousness or will. He gave him another drink, likely coffee, and more sleeping pills, and strangled him, followed by having oral sex with his dead body. He decapitated and flayed the body, leaving the skin in a solution of borax, salt, and cold water to attempt to preserve it. However, after several weeks it had become too frayed to keep and had to be discarded. He took Polaroids of Lindsay before and during the dismemberment of his body, putting his bones and flesh into barrels filled with acid. His head was boiled in Soilex and water, and the clean skull was kept in the apartment, which helped detectives identify him through dental records. Errol Lindsay was a member of the choir at the Greater Spring Hill Missionary Baptist Church. His sister, Rita, was enraged at Dharma's trial, saying that she wanted him to see what out of control looked like. There is no memorial site listed for this victim, as there were no remains to find except for his skull. His sister said that he had wanted to become a boxer and that Dharma only managed to do what he did because he dragged her brother. If he had not been dragged, he would have fought Dharma off without a hitch. Rest in peace, Errol Lindsay, 3rd of March 1972 to the 7th of April 1991. Anthony Hughes, May 24th, 1991. 31-year-old Anthony Hughes arrived in Milwaukee from Madison, Wisconsin on Friday afternoon to visit his family. After he had gone out that evening, his mother, Shirley Hughes, had never seen him again. He was deaf and mute, but liked to go out and hang out in bars in West Allis, where he was able to lip read or communicate through written notes. He also had a group of friends that were deaf-mute, and they liked to go out together on weekends. Dharma met him outside of Club 219 and was apparently acquainted with his victim for some time. He approached Tony while he was with his group of friends, offering him $50 to come back to his apartment with him for a photo shoot and sex. He agreed, and his friends drove the pair to 23rd and Wells, where they got out and walked to the apartment. Dharma did not want his friends to know where he lived. Once in the apartment, he poured his friend a generous drink and stirred in the crushed sleeping pills he had prepared. Once he had fallen asleep, a hole was drilled in his head and filled with muriatic acid. Dharma lay next to him and fell asleep, waking to find Hughes dead next to him. His second zombie experiment was a failure. Disappointed, he waited 3 days and then dragged Hughes' body to the bathroom where he dismembered him, keeping only his skull after all the flesh was removed. Detectives were able to positively identify this victim through known dental records compared with the unpainted skulls in the apartment. There were no Polaroids taken of this victim. He was reported missing on May 31st, 1991. Shirley Hughes, Anthony's mother, says that Dharma must have been lying because her son had $400 in his pocket that night and certainly did not need the $50 that he was offering. She later sought damages for her son's wrongful death, where Judge Robert Landry approved the claim of $10 million in punitive damages, $50,000 for his wrongful death, $3,300 in funeral expenses, and $100,000 for her son's lost wages. No burial or memorial site is listed for this victim. Rest in peace, Tony Hughes, 1960 to the 24th of May, 1991. Conorak Synthasomphone, May 27th, 1991. Jeffrey Dharma molested and assaulted a 14-year-old Laotian boy in 1988, for which he received a 1-year work release sentence and 5 years probation charge. Somsak Synthasomphone was lucky to escape him, but tragically his brother would encounter Dharma at the Grand Avenue Mall on a Sunday afternoon 3 years later, while he was still on probation. Dharma maintained that this was a coincidence, and that he had not known that Konarek was Somsek's brother. He spotted him entering the mall as he was leaving and found him attractive, so he decided to pursue him. He approached Konarek and offered him money to return home with him for a photo shoot, telling him how attractive he was and that he would make a good model. According to Dahmer, the boy was hesitant at first, but he knew just how to coax young victims into trusting him completely, and the pair made their way to his apartment. Once there, Dahmer made him a drink and asked him to pose for him in his underwear, taking two pictures before the boy was knocked out. He engaged in sex with his unconscious body while watching a video in the background and, once satisfied, drilled a series of holes in the top of Konarek's head. Evidence revealed four holes drilled into the skull, injecting boiling water into each. This was a new attempt at creating a sex slave, and, once confident that his victim would not be able to think for himself anymore, he headed out to the Gerber Tavern to drink beer until closing time. On his way back to his apartment in the early morning hours of May 27, 1991, the last thing that he had anticipated was seeing his victim sitting on the curb in the nude, surrounded by two concerned women who had just called the police. Konarek had woken up and managed to get out of the apartment and sway out into the street, mumbling incoherently and allegedly bleeding from his rectum. The two women, Sandra Smith and Nicole Childress, who had spotted him, called 911 to alert them about a child on the street in the nude who was bruised and bleeding and was not able to speak properly. Dahmer walked up to them calmly, telling NBC in an interview after his capture that he had to quickly come up with a story. He told the woman that Konarek was his 19-year-old boyfriend who had a little bit too much to drink and that he always got like this when he was drunk. He explained that they had an argument and that he had gone out to get some more beers and some fresh air. Police and the fire department arrived at the scene, where the woman and Dahmer collectively tried to explain to them what had happened while they covered the boy with a blanket. He told the police that Childress was just another black bitch and that there was something wrong with her. Once police were confident that this was nothing more than a homosexual lover's spat, two officers escorted Konarek back up to Dahmer's apartment, each holding one arm. During questioning, Dahmer related how it felt like he could get away with his crimes after this incident, because while he had felt extremely nervous, he had managed to convince authorities and neighbors that it was nothing more than a lover's quarrel. On entering the apartment, they were able to observe Konarek's folded clothing on the couch and the photos that Dahmer had taken of him, and they left, assuring the woman that everything had been taken care of. One of the women called again, concerned that the child was not okay, but officers assured her that it was a boyfriend situation, and that the child was in fact an adult, and that she needed to put the matter to rest. Officers Balzerak and Gabrish were suspended once Dahmer had been captured and the true horror of the situation came to light, but were later reinstated. They maintained that no officers could have known that there was anything out of the ordinary, except for the smell of the apartment, of course. Dahmer, on the other hand, confessed that Hughes's dead body was still on the floor in his bedroom at the time, and that Konarek had seen it but not reacted due to the sedatives in his system. Once officers left the apartment, Dahmer injected a second dose of boiling water into Konarek's brain, which proved to be fatal. Aroused by his death, he engaged in necrophilia and then requested a day of leave for the next day so that he could take the time to dismember the bodies of Tony Hughes and Konarek Synthesimphone. On Tuesday, May 28, 1991, Dahmer dismembered his victims and discarded their remains in trash bags, keeping only their skulls, which still had the drill holes in them. He had been reported missing on May 26, 1991, the same day that he had been murdered. He was the youngest of eight children from a family originally from Laos, who had escaped a communist nation to settle in Milwaukee, where some relatives already lived. He liked Ninja Turtles, Tom and Jerry cartoons, soccer, and Lamborghinis. He was a courageous kid who managed to escape Dharma at least once, as his brother did. His home was only 3 miles away from the apartment where he lost his life. The city of Milwaukee later settled a lawsuit and paid the Cynthas Somphone family $850,000 for the way that police officers handled the situation. Had the police scanned Dharma's identification, they would have noticed that he was a registered sex offender on probation for child molestation, which could possibly have saved Conorak's life and captured the Milwaukee Monster before he got to 4 more victims. His memorial stone can be found at Holy Cross Cemetery and Mausoleum in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the same cemetery where Curtis Straughter's memorial stone is. Rest in peace, Conorak Cynthas Somphone, 2nd of December 1976 to the 27th of May 1991. Matt Turner, June 30th, 1991. On Sunday, June 30th, 1991, Dharma took a Greyhound bus to Chicago, Illinois to attend the Chicago Pride Parade, where 100,000 people attended the annual celebration. Matt Turner, also known by his lip-syncing stage name as Donald Montrell, was a 20-year-old eccentric, flamboyant, and bubbly young man who loved to sing and dance. He also loved to dress up and pose for photos, something that Dharma must have learned after striking up a conversation with him at the parade. Without hesitation, he invited Turner to return with him to Milwaukee for a professional photo shoot, offering him a cash reward for being his model. Turner enthusiastically agreed, imagining his poses and pouts for his new photographer friend. At the end of the parade, Dharma bought 2 tickets for a Greyhound bus ride back home, one for him and one for Turner. They had 2 to 3 hours to chat and laugh, possibly still buzzing from a few drinks that they had at the event. Turner worked at a pizza restaurant in Chicago, where customers remembered him as an energetic, chatty person. He would never be seen again. Once they arrived in Milwaukee, they took a cab from the bus station to Dharma's apartment, where he was given a cocktail. After posing for some nude photographs and playing with each other, Turner passed out from the sedatives and Dharma strangled him to death with a strap. During the interviews and interrogations with the police, Dharma pointed out that he did not have sex with this victim's body after he was dead. He dismembered him, discarded of his flesh in the trash, wrapped his organs and muscle tissue in plastic bags, and stored them with his severed head in the freezer. His torso was discarded in a blue barrel containing an acid solution in his bedroom. He was identified through photographs by the killer and friends from Chicago. This victim was never reported missing as his family got used to him gallivanting here and there. Within 1 month, they would hear the unfortunate news about what happened to him. There is no memorial site listed for him. Rest in peace, Matt Turner, 15th of October, 1970, to the 30th of June, 1991. Jeremiah Weinberger, July 7th, 1991. 23-year-old Puerto Rican Jeremiah Weinberger was a customer service agent in the video sales department of a cinema in Chicago, where he shared an apartment with some roommates in the north of the city. He was known for his friendly nature. Even Dharma described him as exceptionally affectionate and nice to be with. Jeff enjoyed the bars and clubs in Chicago so much that he booked another ticket to the city just 1 week after luring Matt Turner home. On arrival on the evening of Saturday, July 6, 1991, he headed to Carol's Speakeasy, a well-known bar and dance club in Old Town Chicago, where he met Jeremiah. The two hit it off and enjoyed the party scene together until closing time around 4 a.m. Dharma invited his new friend back home with him, a 90-mile bus ride away. He most likely pitched the idea as a fantastic opportunity to hang out, drink, and play around together, have a photo shoot, and see where things go. Before Weinberger agreed, he first checked what his friend thought of Dharma, to which the reply was, "He seems all right." The pair headed to the station and took a Greyhound bus back to Milwaukee, where they then took a cab to the apartment. According to Dharma, Jeremiah stayed with him for 2 days, and they had a great time, engaging in the light sex and affection that he craved so much. At some point, Jeremiah decided that he wanted to head back home to Chicago, likely to get back to work, which Dharma took personally. He convinced Jeremiah to stay for just one more drink, which was naturally laced with several sedatives. Once his guest had become drowsy and fallen asleep, Dharma's drill came out, and boiling water was injected into his skull. Weinberger woke up a few hours later, groggy but still wanting to leave. He was given another drink and another injection, which put him in a coma. By this time, Dharma had to go to work, and it was on his return that he found Weinberger dead where he left him, apparently the only one who died with his eyes open. He dismembered him, Polaroid camera in hand every step of the way, and discarded of his flesh in the trash. He pushed his body into the acid barrel and placed his severed head in the freezer alongside Matt Turner's. This victim was identified by the killer through photographs, as well as through evidence and remains found in the apartment. Sadly, the friend who had told Weinberger that Dharma seemed all right felt so guilty that he took his own life shortly after hearing of his murder. Jeremiah's father, Aaron Weinberger, sued Jeff's probation officer, Donna Chester, when he learned that she had not visited the killer's home for probation inspections, but he did not win the case. Chester had been given permission from her supervisor to check on Dharma telephonically rather than visiting him in his apartment due to the sheer volume of work at the time. Rest in peace, Jeremiah Weinberger, 26th of September 1968 to the 7th of July 1991. Oliver Lacey, July 15th, 1991. 23-year-old Oliver Lacey was wearing a white t-shirt and jeans when he met Dharma at a bus stop on the corner of 27th and Kilbourn, the same location he met Ernest Miller and Errol Lindsay. After some small talk, Dharma learned that Lacey was a weightlifter and model. He was immediately invited back to the apartment for a professional photo shoot with the ability to earn $50 to $100 in cash for his work as a model. Lacey obliged and the pair took a bus and entered apartment 213 on July 15th, 1991. Lacey's family last saw him on July 12th, 1991, and he was coincidentally reported missing on the day that Dharma had taken him home. When they arrived, Lacey was offered a rum and coke with sleeping pills, which got the pair in the mood for body rubbing and oral sex while they watched a video. It did not take long for Lacey to pass out, after which he was strangled to death. Dharma was so aroused by him that he performed anal sex on the cadaver, and the body was photographed in various positions before dismemberment. He was so attracted to this victim that he even kept his ID and two personal photos from his wallet, because he wanted as many photographs of him as possible. Lacey's head was severed and placed in the refrigerator in a shallow cardboard box with a drip tray below. This was the head that police officers and Tracy Edwards would find in the refrigerator when Dharma was captured on July 22, 1991. He stored this victim's heart in the freezer compartment of his refrigerator for later consumption, which he never got to, and fried up his right bicep and ate it. He kept his head, hands, and torso and discarded the rest of the remains in the trash. Oliver Lacey was identified through dental records, fingerprints, and from the identity card found in the apartment. Lacey left behind his girlfriend, who he planned to marry, and an infant son. A memorial service was held for the once professional athlete, where family members had to be assisted out of the church in a state of hysteric grief. Rest in peace, Oliver Lacey, 23rd of June, 1968, to the 15th of July, 1991. Joseph Braderhoft, July 19th, 1991. 25-year-old Joseph Braderhoft, born in Minnesota, was from Chicago, Illinois, had three children, and had recently separated from his wife when he traveled to Milwaukee in search of a new job. Ironically, this was the same week that Dharma had been fired from the Ambrosia Chocolate Company, so there was plenty of conversational common ground available for small talk. Dharma spotted him at a bus stop across from Marquette University, the same place that he met 17-year-old Curtis Strauter. Brederhoft had a six-pack of beer under his arm, likely on his way back to his brother's house, where he was staying for the time that he was in Wisconsin. Even though Dharma had no money available to offer, he walked up to Brederhoft, invited him back to his place for drinks, movies, and a photo shoot in exchange for $50. Brederhoft needed the money and agreed. According to Dharma, they had oral sex before he offered him a drink, which was laced with his usual concoction of sedatives. Once Brederhoft had fallen asleep, he strangled him to death with a black strap, covered his body with a sheet, and left it on his bed for 2 days. According to some reports, when Dharma lifted the sheets 2 days later, Brederhoff's head was swarming with maggots. He dragged his body to the bathtub, cleaned the head, and dismembered him. His torso was placed in the acid barrel, and his head was stored in the freezer. Dharma also held onto his identification card, possibly a new habit after keeping Weinbergers. This was Dharma's final victim. Rest in peace, Joseph Brederhoft, 24th of January, 1966, to the 19th of July, 1991. Discarding the evidence. Dharma did not hesitate to tell detectives the grisly details of each murder, as well as how he discarded of the remains and how he went undetected for so long. He matter-of-factly shared the following details with them. He got completely naked before dragging his victims' bodies to a drain or bathtub to avoid getting any blood or bodily fluids on him. This made the process much easier for him, where he did not have to worry about soiling his clothes and having to discard them too, which would have increased the possibility of being detected. He took a sharp knife and would cut downwards from the sternum, making sure the laceration was deep enough to access internal organs. Then he would spread the wound and remove all internal organs, cutting them into fist-sized pieces and putting them in triple-bagged trash bags to avoid any leaks or odors. He stripped the flesh from the arms, biceps, chest, and legs, cutting them into chunks for easy disposal. He then skinned the soles of his victim's feet, which he told a medical examiner served the purpose of letting the bones dissolve faster in muriatic acid. Without this step, he said that the dissolving and discarding process took much longer. He always ensured that each bag was not too heavy, approximately 25 pounds as a limit, and discarded them with the rest of the neighborhood's trash. He would then work on destroying the bones, wrapping the head and skeleton in an old sheet to smash them with a sledgehammer, placing the remains of the upper body in one bag and the remains of the lower body into another bag. He told police that he felt an immense sense of loss when he disposed of his victim's remains, thinking that their life was such a waste, that at one time they were a full human being and now they were placed in 4 or 5 bags of trash. However, he liked the sense of control he gained, as well as the excitement of being able to get away with what he had done. Eventually, Dharma would attempt to fully skin his victims, dissect them, cannibalize them, and retain their skulls, hands, bones, and genitals as souvenirs, using them for arousal as he relived the experience with their corpses. He also gained experience in boiling body parts in water and Soilex to completely strip them of flesh, and experimented with freezing, drying, and preserving remains. Some of the genitals found in formaldehyde were painted in a nude color, which Dharma said was to make them look more natural. He bought paint from an art supply store to color the skin before preserving these parts. The first victim that he attempted to skin was Errol Lindsay. He told detectives that he started at the back of the neck and made his way around the body using a paring knife, saying that it was like skinning a chicken and only difficult around the joints. He said that when he got to the face, he had to be careful, but once he had loosened it, it peeled off like a mask. In fact, he told detectives that once he had carefully lifted the skin of the face off, it looked like a mask you can buy at a party store. He placed the skin in a solution of borax, salt, and water, but left it in for too long and was not able to keep it. It had, unfortunately, turned mushy, and his plans to preserve it were ruined. When detectives asked him why he wanted to skin this victim, he said that he just wanted to try it. When detectives asked how the skulls found in his apartment were so clean and dry, he told them that he boiled the heads in Soilex until the neck vertebrae and brain matter got soft. Sometimes he used a syringe to inject Soilex into the skull to speed up the process. He would then use a spoon to scoop everything out of the skull to throw in the toilet, before reboiling it to rid of any hair, flesh, mucus, and matter left. After about 1 hour of boiling, the vertebrae would become soft enough to dislodge, he said. When detectives asked him how he felt about the information that he had given them, he said, "It's hard for me to believe that a human being could have done what I have done, but I know that I did it." He said that he knew exactly which chemicals to use because he had done extensive research, frequently calling hardware stores and taxidermists to figure out how to successfully strip all of the flesh off the bone, telling them that he was trying to skin or strip a rabbit skull. Of course, he also had the experience of dissecting, stripping, skinning, and preserving the remains of the roadkill that he had collected as a teenager. He said, "I always believed the theory of evolution is truth, that we all just came from the slime. When we died, you know, that was it. There is nothing." Jeffrey Dahmer ironically turned his victims into slime, keeping only the parts that he could display as a trophy or happy memory. And even though he believed that after we died, there is nothing, he did not hesitate to shorten the lives of those he wanted to enjoy for himself.